It's actually a fabulous pleasure to be here because Bruce has described this wonderfully fortuitous way that he got hold of my book. And Bruce has, ever since he read the book, been convinced that Alexander Graham Bell was probably bipolar. And I have always wondered about that myself. What I want to do tonight is actually show you some slides and talk a little about why I wrote the book and about Alexander Graham Bell's personality and his extraordinary gifts and achievements. But the part I'm really looking forward to is the conversation afterwards. I'm hoping you're going to have questions. I'm hoping you're going to have your own views on this really extraordinary man. But I'm actually going to start with a photograph that was the spur for me to write the book. And this is a photograph, as you can see, of both the Bells and their very attractive couple. But it wasn't, in fact, Alexander Graham Bell that I was interested in. It was actually Mabel, his wife, who caught my interest. Because you look at Bell himself, and frankly, he's very familiar. He's just another ancient high achiever like Albert Einstein or Mick Jagger, you know, wrinkled. very familiar. But I had never seen a picture of his wife before, and I was fascinated that they were holding hands. I mean, when did you last see a picture of maybe your great-grandparents or someone from sort of early 20th century, a couple, holding hands, or a husband looking so affectionately at his wife? And I could see they obviously had an extraordinarily close relationship, because in every photo of the two of them, they're either holding hands or looking very directly at each other. And she was obviously an impressive personality. Actually, she reminded me of the sort of brainy, intense women who had taught me in all the old women's educational institutions that I'd been to in England. Certain sort of common characteristics: untidy hair, strange clothes, and very high standards. And then I discovered why, in fact, you could tell from these photographs, these very unusual photographs of very close relationship, why they were always holding hands. And that's because she was stone deaf, completely deaf, and it was a very practical reason. They may have done it anyway, because in fact, as I said, they were very close. But in fact, Mabel had lost her hearing after a fever when she was 5 years old. And Alec and she always held hands, because sometimes he would be writing on her hand for her. Sometimes he would be tugging her hand to get her attention, because he couldn't just say to her, Mabel, she wouldn't hear him. And he wanted to say something to him. And that's why they were sort of in constant physical contact. Now, I'm going to tell you a little about the two of them, because she and Alec met when she was 15 and he was 25. And at that stage in his career, Bell was earning his living in Boston, in the States, as a teacher of the deaf. And she came to him for lessons in articulation, a word I'm having a problem with, so it's not surprising she did, really. Now, when I write a biography, and I've written 9 books, the 9th is coming out in September, but most of them have been biographies, and what I've discovered I really need for the kind of biographies I want to write, which take you really inside the personality, is need tons of primary material, and that means letters, memoirs, diaries, journals, personal material that tells me what my subjects were thinking and feeling, as well as doing. And I was thrilled to discover that the Bell archive was huge. There were 2 complete sets of papers. One was in the Library of Congress in Washington, in the States, and the other one was at the Bell Museum in Burdick, Cape Breton, Nova Scotia. And both of them had Bell's laboratory notebooks, his technical drawings, his copies of a family newspaper, household notes, journal, travel, diaries, photographs, and lots of correspondence, lots and lots of letters. I'm one of life's natural nosy parkers. I love reading other people's letters. In the Bell Museum in Burdick, there are 180 3-ring binders full of letters. Him to her, her to him, letters to parents, children, and it was an absolute gold mine. And what's more, anybody who's actually tried to read their parents' or their grandparents' letters will understand why I was particularly thrilled. They were typed. I did not have to read the handwriting, which can be awful. Now, I assumed that I'd actually do the research in Washington, which is more accessible from Ottawa, where I live. Griffith than Bedeck is. But I went to Bedeck and realized it was one of the most beautiful places in Canada. Have any of you been to the Bedeck Museum? So you know how fantastic Cape Breton is, and the history, the Bell site there is lovely. As I said, I'd started thinking I was going to write a biography of Mabel, because most of my previous books had been biographies of women. But as I was going through all this material, I realized that she was a really impressive woman, but what an intriguing relationship. What an extraordinary man. What an incredible mind. What a range of interests, from communications to genetics, from flying machines to farming, and yet he had the most incredible resistance to actually making any money from his inventions. He just loved doing it, but he was so impractical. The letters were fantastic. I'm just going to read you a short extract from one, and I'm going to read it just so you can see, first of all, how thrilling it is to sort of get this insight into an individual, but you can also see how intense he was. And this is a letter that he wrote to Mabel, March 1879, after their marriage. He wrote to her, "I have my periods of restlessness when my brain is crowded with ideas, tingling to my fingertips, when I am excited and cannot stop for anybody. Let me alone, let me work as I like, even if I have to sit up all night, or even for two nights. When you see me flagging, getting tired, discouraged, put your hands over my eyes so that I go to sleep, and let me sleep as long as I like until I wake. And then I may hang around, read novels, and be stupid without an idea in my head, until I get rested and ready for another period of work. But oh, do not do as you often do. Stop me in the midst of my work, my excitement with, 'Alec, Alec, aren't you coming to bed? It's 1 o'clock. Do come.' Then I have to come feeling cross and ugly. And then you put your hands on my eyes, and after a while I go to sleep. But the ideas are gone. The work is never done." Pretty intense, right? We know people like that, and they are often brilliant, but they're very difficult to live with. "I wanted to give Mabel Bell her due as an important partner in her husband's life, because actually she financed most of his work, and she'd also organized their life together so he could pursue his obsessions." Just before I move on, that's one of the laboratory notebooks that I found at Bedeck, and this in fact is an absolutely crucial page where he's first talking when he was working on the development of the telephone. "I realized that Alexander himself, his inventions and his telephone was only one of many. His brain, his needs, his fame, his personality was actually the driving force of this marriage. And Mabel Bell was at one level the most traditional of 19th century wives, devoted exclusively to domestic and family concerns. Her life revolved around Alec. So the reluctant genius became front and center, although Mabel is always there, holding his hand. And there was another reason why I became increasingly focused on Bell himself. That jolly old Santa figure that we all recognize as the inventor of the telephone, you know, the one that's been on the stamps and that you see endlessly reproduced, that image doesn't begin to capture this guy. Because Bell, particularly in his younger years, was not a serene, benevolent personality. He was neurotic, obsessive, and a rather cadaverous young man, often close to break down. He was a night owl who might go without sleep for days, who hated every aspect of business, and who had an extremely difficult relationship with his father. How had this intense young teacher of the deaf solved the technical challenge that had defeated so many other ambitious young inventors in Europe and North America? How had an impoverished young Scotsman who never graduated from university invented what was initially called a talking telegraph, and of course we know as the telephone? And more fundamentally, what is genius? How did Bell's mind work? How did he achieve the eureka moment of invention, the insight that eluded all his contemporaries, that allowed him to understand the transmission of sound? And what was it like to be a young man interested in electricity, just as the second stage of the Industrial Revolution dawned, the stage at which electricity rather than steam took over as the main source of power? So there I am, sorting through all these sort of different questions, reading all these notebooks, fascinated by, first of all, Mabel, then their relationship, then realizing Alec was actually going to have to be the center of the book. And I realized Alec was the lead. And by now, as you can tell, I'm on first name terms with both Alec and Mabel as I pore through their correspondence. In fact, I have to admit, there were three of us in this marriage. So I'm going to tell you a little about Alec Graham Bell himself, born in Edinburgh in 1847, middle of three sons of Eliza and Melville Bell, an elocution teacher. Melville Bell, his father, had invented an extraordinary system of notation called visible speech, a system of hieroglyphics that allowed him to write down and then reproduce any sound uttered by the human voice, whether or not the person who noted the sound understood what it meant or not. So, I mean, it was a very strange idea. You're reproducing sounds and you have no idea what they mean. But Melville Bell saw visible speech as the brilliant intellectual breakthrough that would make his fortune, and he was determined that his three sons, especially Alec, the middle one, who was very, very musical, would be his visible speech salesman. So this is the visible speech primer. I mean, you can spend hours poring over it, as I did, sort of trying to work it out and trying to think, what use is this? But Alec had other ideas. He wanted to get a university education. He wanted to escape his father's overbearing presence, and he was trapped. But the scourge of tuberculosis, which was the same kind of plague in the late 19th century as HIV/AIDS is now, struck his older and younger brothers. And by the time he was 23, by the time Alec was 23, both his brothers were dead. And Alec had become not only his parents' only child, but also the focal point for all their hopes for the future. And I realized, I sorted through his early life and everything, sort of how to tell that story. That was a crippling responsibility for him. Eliza and Melville Bell were determined not to lose their last remaining son. And that's why the Bell family came to Canada, which was then widely advertised within the smut-encrusted cities of industrial Britain as the land of health. And the Bell family landed in Quebec City in August 1870, made their way to Brantford in Ontario because they had family friends there. When Alec arrived to live in this very nice house, he was incredibly sick. He stood well over 6 foot. He weighed only 130 pounds. He almost certainly did have TB, and in subsequent years he told friends that he'd come to Canada to die. But for once, Canadian government advertising told the truth. He did recover his health in Canada, and then he looked around for something to do. He'd always been interested in science. When he was a boy, he'd invented a speaking machine, and he rigged up a primitive telegraph line between his house and his neighbours. And he knew that the race was on to improve the telegraph that Samuel Morse had invented about 33 years earlier, but he had to earn his living. And it pains me to say this as a Canadian, he had to get out of Canada. As long as he was in Brantford, his father harangued him about selling visible speech. And the only employable skill Alec had was to be a teacher of the deaf, and he needed to find a school in the States where he could use that. The one he went to was in Boston, Massachusetts, and he ended up there 8 months after he'd arrived in North America. For the next 3 years, he spent his days teaching deaf children to lip read and to articulate. And throughout his life, Alexander Graham Bell was torn between his urge to invent and a deeply felt commitment, a really passionate commitment to the interests of deaf people. But at night, he always closed his notebooks on deaf education. He drew the blinds in his shabby little apartment and worked until dawn on telegraph experiments. And the challenge at this stage for people like him, Thomas Edison, and the Chicago electrician Elisha Gray was to invent a multiple telegraph, a system that could carry more than one message at a time on a telegraph wire using the Morse code. And by now, Alec at least had a source of some limited funding for his experimental work. He'd recently taken on as a pupil Mabel Hubbard, the 15-year-old daughter of a Boston patent attorney, Gardner Hubbard. Pretty significant that Mabel's husband is a patent attorney. Hubbard had agreed to put up some money to cover the young Scotsman's expenses and provide him with an assistance. And the breakthrough for Alec came in the summer of 1875. In the fierce heat of a Boston June, his attic workroom was steamy as he and his assistant, Thomas Watson, bent over their blueprints, tuning forks, steel rods, and electromagnets. And this is the diagram of what he was playing with. I mean, it just looks incredibly complicated now. I mean, think about it. Many of us in our pockets have a cell phone which is about that big and about that thin. This huge piece of laboratory equipment that they constructed is the origin of it. By the attic's grime-encrusted arched window, oblivious to the quiet hiss of an overhead gas lamp, Alec crouched over his latest prototype for the telegraph transmitter. He was trying to tune the receiver reeds. One minute he would summon his assistant Watson to help him fix a detail. The next he would send him to the next room to see if a receiver there was working. And the breakthrough came on June the 2nd as the two men, sleeves rolled up and foreheads glistening in the oppressive heat, tested out a trio of transmitters and receivers. As Watson adjusted the spring of one of the receivers in the adjoining room, Alec realized that the corresponding transmitter in his laboratory had spontaneously begun to vibrate. He put his ear next to it and heard a distinct twang. He dashed next door to see what Watson was doing to cause the vibration. Watson explained that he had plucked the spring, and Alec then said something that I have to be really careful when I quote it. Alec snapped, "Keep plucking it." They plucked on. He had immediately grasped the import of that twang for the speaking telegraph that had continued to haunt his imagination. The plucked spring was inducing the wave-shaped current he had thought about the previous year and tried to think how to reproduce it. And he and his assistant worked far into the night, repeated the discovery with all the steel rods and tuning forks that they could find. And his assistant Watson later recalled, "Before we parted, Bell sketched for me the first electric speaking telephone and said, have it ready by tomorrow evening." Amazingly, Watson actually managed that, and with several refinements, these sketches were the designs for the instrument that would become the first telephone. Meanwhile, of course, Alec was falling in love with Mabel, and then her father, Gardner Hubbard, mentioned his daughter, Mabel, was leaving Cambridge in a couple of weeks and would be out of town for the entire summer. So you have Alec being this incredibly intense inventor one minute, and then hearing that the woman he has barely even able to admit to himself he has feelings for is leaving town. And in a very typical pattern, he just goes off the deep end. The news of Mabel's departure forced Alexander Graham Bell to confront the feelings he'd been repressing for months. The idea of Mabel spending weeks so far removed from him horrified him. He admitted to him finally that he daydreamed for hours when he might take that fair young girl, as he called her, because she's still very young, in his arms, and his emotions just boiled over. And he declared himself in a letter to Mabel's mother, and he sat down and wrote this letter, which has to be one of the sort of least gracious admissions of affection I've ever read. He wrote, "Dear Mrs. Hubbard, pardon me for the liberty I take in addressing you at this time. I am in deep trouble and can only go to you for advice. I have discovered that my interest in my dear pupil Mabel has ripened into a far deeper feeling than that of mere friendship. In fact, I know that I have learned to love her very sincerely. Could you suspect how desolate the announcement of her early departure from Cambridge has made me? You would indeed pity me." It's not a declaration that I love your daughter, isn't this wonderful? It's, "I love your daughter, please feel sorry for me." I bet she was thrilled. So the story of Alec's courtship of Mabel is incredibly romantic, and I can tell you as a writer that I did one chapter on the invention of the telephone, for which I had to really work hard. I do not have an advanced education in physics. Sound waves and electricity have always sort of left me just a little uncertain, and so getting the scientific details of that correct was the challenge for one chapter. And then the next chapter, I think I'm writing a Harlequin romance, because it is so romantic when he falls in love with her, because, of course, being Alec, it's incredibly over the top. Remember, he's now a 27-year-old professor at Boston University, and she's a naive 17-year-old daughter of a very rich Boston family. She was good-looking and very clever. I mean, just as an example of how clever she was, she could lip-read. She never learnt to sign. She only learnt lip-reading. And she could lip-read in both English and German. And what's more, if you think about photographs you've seen of people in the late 19th century, think about all the facial hair that men had. And she was lip-reading through all that, which is really an extraordinary achievement. But she was a stone deaf, which was a condition that was widely regarded in the period as an insuperable disability, often linked to intellectual handicaps. It's easy to assume that Alec, 10 years her senior, dominated the relationship from the start. I mean, he was this sort of smart young teacher, and here was his handicapped pupil, who was 10 years younger. Throughout the courtship, and in the 45 years of marriage that lay ahead of the Bells, it's always Mabel who is the navigator. So here she is, she's younger, she's deaf. Everybody assumes that, you know, she's just so lucky getting married at all. But she is the one who brings stability and order to Alec's life. She handled all the domestic and family responsibilities and the financial arrangements. Alexander Graham Bell's patent on the telephone, the famous patent number 174365, which was the most litigated patent in American history, it was contested over 600 times, and he hated dealing with the lawyers that the litigation involved. He even threatened to walk away from it, and it was always Mabel who steeled him for the fight and who, in subsequent years, kept his feet on the ground. The only aspect of his work for which she had little sympathy, ironically, was his work with the deaf. And one of those on whom he expended a lot of care, who knows who Helen Keller was? Do you all? She was so deeply part of my collective, my memory when I was growing up. I was shocked to discover how many people, in fact, haven't heard of her. But I think it's partly generational, those of us who remember that really great movie, which showed the story of Helen Keller, the deaf and blind American child. And Alexander Graham Bell was enormously important in finding her a teacher and allowing her to develop her incredible intellectual skills. She eventually attended Radcliffe College, wrote several books, became one of the most famous personalities of the early 20th century. Mabel always kept her distance from Helen. Why? It was a very complicated relationship. I may come back to that later. Now, the telephone may be the only invention for which Alexander Graham Bell is remembered today, but his fertile brain just teemed with ideas. When American President James Garfield was shot in 1881, Alec created a sonar probe to locate the assassin's bullet. He devised a precursor to the iron lung. He worked on sound communication with beams of light, the idea behind fiber optics. He became a major figure in Washington society, where he was an important regent of the Smithsonian Institute, and where he helped make the National Geographic the most famous magazine in the world. But what he really loved was leaving Washington, getting out of Washington. It was too hot, too formal, too political. And instead, he preferred a remote corner of Canada where he and Mabel and their two daughters, which they originally discovered in 1885, Bedeck. Here it is, the house that they built, a wonderful house on a point into the Bradore Lake. And the house is called Benbrea, Benbrea, which is Scottish Gaelic for beautiful mountain. And it's amazing to think of, actually, because when they moved there and built this house in the 1880s, Cape Breton was 85% Gaelic speaking. The population was so absolutely undiluted Scottish. Now they're working so hard to preserve the Gaelic language, but then he was surrounded by Gaelic speakers, which of course he didn't speak, but he just loved, having come from Scotland, he just loved the idea of it. At Benbrea, Alec would unwind. All those jolly old Santa Claus pictures date from these years. But he remained wonderfully eccentric. He gloried in the beautiful Atlantic storms that often swept across the island as the sky darkened and a chill rain began to fall. I discovered one wonderful letter from a cousin of Mabel's called Mary, and according to her, when there was a great big windstorm, hailstorm, as I said, he hated heat and the climate of Washington. He loved the cold winds of Cape Breton. And as soon as one of these storms swept across the lake, he would strip naked and then put on rubber boots and swimsuit and walk around in the woods. And she describes this terrible moment when, you know, they're all cowering around the fireplace in that lovely house I showed you. And she looks up and looks out of the window. There's this man outside, stark naked except for a swimsuit and rubber boots, sort of waving at her because he's having such a nice time in the storm. His curiosity remained as avid as possible, as avid as ever. He tried to breed a flock of super sheep. His idea was that sheep, you should be able to breed a flock of sheep that would be like pigs, and they would have multiple nipples and multiple births. And instead of having a litter of piglets, you'd have a litter of lambs. So he kept this wonderful flock of sheep. Unfortunately, he got very excited when occasionally there were twins and triplets, but he just could not trace the genetics of his flock, but he couldn't manage to get ones that consistently had twins and triplets. He became increasingly interested in manned flight. And remember, we're now into the early years of aviation. He began by building kites, and his kites got bigger and bigger and bigger. This is just a huge one, and it was large enough that they, with all of these sort of incredible kites he was building, he was trying to get them that they were actually strong and large enough that they could lift a man off the ground. He didn't do it with a ring kite, but he did manage with a tetrahedral kite. And here you can actually see it lifting the man. Can you see it's lifting a man off the ground? And he's thrilled because now he's proven that a kite can be used for airborne travel. Mabel helped him. Again, I mean, he's getting carried away with aviation. Mabel helped him by recruiting 4 smart young men with similar interests to work on his flying machines. They were called Bell's Boys, and they would soon return. They soon persuaded him that, in fact, kites was not the way to go, that he needed to go to winged flight, which the Wright brothers were already known to have achieved in 1903 at Kitty Hawk. So here we have one of his prototypes. And in 1908, Alex Group managed to build 4 different prototypes of flying machines. When the Silver Dart soared over Cape Breton's Bradore Lake in February 1909, it became the first flight of a winged machine by a British subject in the British Empire. And there's a wonderful account in the letters of they're all so completely thrilled that they managed this. So, and after all the sort of little boys in the Bedeck village had run after the biplane, there's this incredible picture of them all with their woolen mittens waving like mad and leather boots. They all go back to Ben Vrier and have what was always served there, which is homemade raspberry vinegar. I never understood that. In his late 60s, Alex's brain was as fertile as ever. His next project was flying boats or hydrofoils. In 1919, he succeeded in building the fastest boat in the world, a record that his vessel held for over a decade. And he also began to worry about environmental pollution. In a conversation with a New York reporter, he even used the phrase greenhouse effect. So as you can tell, I was absolutely stunned by the range of Alex's interests and eccentricities. And I haven't even scratched the surface of them here tonight. I was spellbound, too, by the wonderful woman who sustained him. And as with my previous biographies, I found it so hard to say goodbye when I reached the end of the story. With the very first book I wrote, I found it so hard to say goodbye to Isabel King, who was the subject of it, that I spun her death out for 3 chapters. And my editor kept writing in the margin, "I am getting tired. I am getting very tired." So I got it down to one chapter. I felt a haunting sense of loss of missing them once I'd written the final paragraph. 2 particular discoveries in the Bell archive unnerved me. The first was that Mabel Bell's original choice for a biographer for her husband was Lytton Strachey. So that was a rather high standard to set. But he was at the height of his reputation after the publication of Eminent Victorians. And the second discovery I made was a note from Mabel to her son-in-law saying that she thought Alex's biographer should be a man. But my biography really is a double biography because Mabel herself was such an important part of Alex's life. Without her father's insistence that he patent his invention, without her steady support during his mercurial moods and impatience with business, we might never have heard of Alexander Graham Bell. Thank you. So that's my story of both writing the book and also of Bell himself, to give you a little background. But now it's your turn. And do you have any questions about writing, about Bell, about what it was like to spend 3 years of my life with a very eccentric person? Yes.
Well, first of all, thank you for such an interesting story.
Oh, thank you.
You must feel like you really knew him personally. The question I have bipolar illness myself. And the one thing we all seem to have in common is sleep problems. And of course, people that were really, really manic often didn't get a lot of sleep. So I just wondered if you knew how many hours he usually slept a night, if there was any consistency.
He hated going to bed, and he often would go round the clock, wide awake. It's funny, you know, when I was working in Bedeck, they have a very good library of all the different sort of books and books that mention him. And in fact, I realized that many people have said they suspected he was bipolar. He's also claimed by people who are advocates, groups looking after Asperger's or autism or OCDC. And in fact, one of the most amazing things about Bell I found was an account by a manservant they had in Washington, where he described what it was like being his personal manservant and how ritualistic he was. So that he would go to bed very, very late. They had to have very dark curtains in his bedroom to shut the light out. And the manservant would, I think he'd ring a bell. Bell would ring a bell when he was ready for breakfast. And the manservant would take the tray up with porridge in a white bowl. Bell wouldn't eat off patterned plates. He couldn't bear patterned plates. And be no conversation at all. He'd take the breakfast in, he'd put it by his employer's bedside, and then he'd leave. He might draw the curtains. He would draw the curtains if Bell had said to go ahead. And then there were all kinds of other rituals that Bell would go before he'd finally sort of come downstairs. If during this sort of long sequence of actions that would begin the day for Alec, he was interrupted. Somebody would come in before he'd read the newspaper, before he'd smoked his cigar. He would be totally polite, totally gracious to them, and they'd leave. And then he'd go to bed, and they'd have to go start at the beginning and do the whole ritual again. You can imagine that, in fact, it was hard for me, who, because I'm not a psychiatrist, to know which label to mention, because he's like all of us. He had his behavior didn't particularly fit one diagnosis, one mold. But what I thought was amazing was that while Mabel kept him grounded and sort of made sure that he did get sleep, and because the other thing he would do when he was up in Bedeck, he would get so excited about a project, he'd forget to change his clothes, he'd forget to wash, he'd forget to shave, she wasn't there. By the time she got back from Washington, you know, he looked like the wild man of the woods, and she would say, well, now, Alec, come on. But at the same time, he was her conduit into the speaking world. They were very close when they went to dinner parties in Washington, which neither of them particularly enjoyed, but they felt they should do so that their daughters had a social life in Washington. He would always make sure that if she couldn't see the speaker, he would mouth the words to her so she could knew what the conversation was. And he took great care that she was always included in every family event, family occasion. And actually, when I said described how sad I was to say goodbye to them, after his death in 1922, she'd really, at that stage, her vision was going, and so she couldn't really see very well, and she couldn't hear. She had a breakdown, and she died within 6 months, because they needed each other. Their disabilities meshed really well, so that they could compensate for each other's disabilities. But sleep, that was not his strength.
He basically got very little of it.
He got very little, yeah, and he resented it.
The most amazing story I ever heard about someone functioning with minimal sleep was a documentary on Napoleon. They said that he would sleep 10 minutes or so on a chair, and then he'd just get up and he'd have all kinds of energy and dictate 125 letters a day and all this stuff. And we're told that we need our sleep, right? And I know that if I don't get my sleep, I become unraveled. So it's so important. But there are a few individuals that got by, I guess, with just their makeup or whatever.
Yeah.
Everybody's different, even if you have bipolar.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you, when you were doing your research or in your finished book, did you establish any connections between the almost irony of Alexander Rendell inventing an instrument that allowed people to talk at a distance without seeing each other, while he was himself an instructor and his wife was unable to hear? So do you think that his previous job, his relationship with Mabel, might have influenced the research and the eventual invention of the telephone, or do you think they are completely isolated elements?
He was always interested in the transmission of sound, and that's why he came to invent the telephone, and that's why he was teaching Mabel, because understanding how the ear worked and sort of how the brain absorbs sound was his specialty, and that came very directly from his father's work as an elocution teacher. Of course, you're absolutely right. It's such an irony that his greatest invention was one his wife couldn't use because she couldn't hear. But sound, in general, was what tied together all the different aspects of his life that you've mentioned.
I've heard about the short hours of sleep and the highs, but I haven't really heard about the lows in the talk, like the bipolar low. Was that there too?
I think it was. I think, you see, when he was low, everything ground to a halt, and he wasn't writing diaries, he wasn't writing letters, he wasn't keeping lab notes. So there are gaps, but I don't know what was happening in those. And Mabel writes about how grumpy he could be. There were periods when he didn't sleep at all, and others when he seemed to sleep a lot. But it was never, of course, described as depression or a low or anything. It was just seen as a rhythm.
Maybe people just didn't go to the doctors in those days.
It wasn't until the early 20th century that you had what were then described as alienists, and are now we would describe as psychoanalysts or psychiatrists, depending on their training. But there was no kind of mental health profession in the late 19th century.
Mabel then speak?
Yes, she could, because she hadn't gone deaf. She had had scarlet fever when she was 5, and that's when she lost her hearing. But, of course, she was able to speak before she was 5, and her mother was determined to keep her in the speaking world. And she came from this very loving family of 4 daughters, and they just continued treating her as completely normal, but making sure that she learned to lip read.
Are there any recordings of her?
There's none of her. I do know that, in fact, some people later in life, because she couldn't hear what she sounded like, her voice did sometimes strike people as odd. But, of course, the family was so completely used to it that for them it was their mum. But it's funny you should ask about any recordings of his voice, because I found it so frustrating that I didn't know what his voice sounded like, given that sound was so important. Before she died, I met his last surviving granddaughter. She was a very elderly lady of 99 when I met her in a retirement home in Washington, D.C., and I went to see her, and she was this very hunched, very small, blind, great difficulty moving, and as sharp as a whip. I mean, just incredible. And I said to her at one point, "What did your grandfather sound like? Did he have a Scottish accent?" And she said, "He sounded like you." Because actually Lowland Scots have never had sort of particularly strong accents. But that was what I thought he sounded like. Just before Christmas last year, I got a call from the Smithsonian magazine in Washington. In the Smithsonian Museum, they discovered that they had wax cylinders, which were from Bell's Washington laboratory. And they'd found the technology to take the sound off these wax cylinders, which were sort of very early recording devices. And I heard his voice. I was doing an article about it, but I heard his voice, and in fact there is a very definite Scottish burr to it in that he rolls his R's, but it was actually quite wonderful. I mean, he sort of spoke to me across the years. Yeah, it was sort of lovely.
I wanted to find out about his daughters and his life as a parent. Was he very involved with his daughters?
Fairly typical of dads of his period. He adored them, but it was his wife's job to raise them. And the 2 daughters, they both made very good marriages. One married a young man who became the editor of the National Geographic magazine, and the other married Ed Fairchild, who was a plant biologist. And they were a very close family all the time. But now, Ben Vrier in Bedeck is still owned by the Bell family. And from those 2 daughters, there's about 100 descendants. And it's a wonderful house with all kinds of outbuildings dating from Bell's ownership of this, the headland that it's on. There's a boathouse, the kite house, the caretaker's house, and then places called things like the hut and the cabin. And all these relatives have different, each of these goes to one of the families that still spend a lot of time every summer there.
Why didn't Helen Keller get along with Mabel?
Well, it's a very interesting question, that, because Mabel did not want to be defined by being as a deaf person. Mabel shunned Alec's work with deaf people because she wanted to be absolutely absorbed into the mainstream speaking world, and she didn't want to be seen as another Helen Keller. Not that she would have, because she didn't have the disabilities that Helen Keller had, but she wanted to be just part of the normal speaking world, and she didn't want to be absorbed as a spokesperson for deaf people and then be defined as deaf.
Wasn't she a little bit jealous of Helen Keller too? She was quite pretty and her eyes were quite beautiful.
Well, Helen Keller was the most incredible flirt. I mean, reading about Helen Keller was one of the revelations to me. And one of the most unnerving things is that her own eyes, this is a bit ghoulish, I think. Her own eyes were quite unattractive. They were crossed and squinty. And so she had them replaced by the most beautiful glass blue eyes. The way she talked to people and the way she had a lot of marvelous mentors and patrons, including the writer at the end of the 19th century. His name will come to me in a minute, who lived in just north of Boston.
Oh, Mark Twain.
Thank you. Samuel, yeah. He was another of her great admirers, yeah. And she would, I mean, you know, she would send telegrams to Bell saying, I'm appearing on a stage in New York, please can you come and interpret for me? And he would sign, he would spell out whatever the questions the audience was asking. He'd stand there holding her hand and spelling it out. So I think it must have been very disturbing, actually, for Mabel to see Helen Keller yanking his chain.
Two questions. One was the original telephone sort of designed in terms of like the larynx or something, because it said membrane and diaphragm, and I'm just wondering if that's what he used to sort of, because it is sound, right? And he had been working that with his dad. And the other question, his relationship with his parents, were they still alive when he married Mabel? Like, because I was just wondering that the house was in Cape Breton, not Ontario, where they were, so I was just wondering if it was dynamic. Or...
The first question about the sound, yes, the early telephone used a diaphragm. It was a mad race between three or four different inventors. But what Bell understood was how the telephone worked with the eardrum, and that's what he reproduced. And that was because he was an educator of the deaf. And that's what he reproduced in his prototype telephone. And he understood sort of the theory of sound waves. In terms of his parents, they were pretty suffocating. As I said, they adored him. He was their only surviving son. They'd come to Canada to save his life, and they did save his life. His father was determined he should be spending all his time on visible speech, and Bell didn't want to do that. His mother, interestingly, was deaf, so that he had a lot of experience of close family members who were deaf. But I think he definitely didn't want to live too close to his parents to begin with. But once he'd been established in Washington, his parents left Brantford in Ontario and had a house in Washington and would frequently go to Benbria with them. So they were close. Once he was established and his father had given up trying to force him to be a salesman.
They accepted Mabel then because...
Yes, they did. Oh, yes, they did. Oh, I think they were pretty proud because, I mean, he was penniless and she came from this sort of wealthy Brahmin, Boston Brahmin family, and she was so helpful and important to him.
So it looks like he did make a substantial amount of money, judging by the house and his research on the plane. But my question is about the plane. So this is just 6 years after Kitty Hawk. The plane that he
Silver Dart?
And flew... Was there anything unique about it? Was it much different from the Wright brothers?
Each one of the planes, I mean, the principle was always the same, but each of them was sort of slightly different, had modifications. And because I know as much about aviation as I know about sound technology, don't press me on this, but there are patents, about 8 patents related to airplane design, which a lot of which were to do with the ailerons on the wings for balance, the way they treated the canvas that was covered the wings, the design of the undercarriage, I think, was one of them. But just to give you a sense of him as a scientist, he did everything by himself in his head. I mean, he'd have assistants, but it all had to happen in his head. And at his death, I think he had something like 34 patents. His exact contemporary was Thomas Edison, who approached scientific research and invention in a completely different way. In a way, Bell almost belongs to the 18th century in terms of sort of an Enlightenment philosopher thinking through things in his own head. Edison was very 20th century, understanding the whole process of R&D and the race to invent and to patent and to make money and to mass produce. When Edison died, he had something like 1,100 patents because he was into sort of serious money-making out of his inventions, and he would use a team to develop his ideas, whereas everything was in Bell's head.
See the movie?
Can you see the movie?
Yeah.
The Helen Keller movie?
No, the one about the...
Oh, no. No, you just get my slides tonight. I don't have a movie. Sorry about that. It's false advertising. Yes?
Well, just wondering, Kelly's father, was he something called visible speech?
Yeah.
I understand. What is that?
Visible speech? Well, I spend quite a lot of time on it in the book because it's really one of those sort of ideas that could only happen in the late 19th century when everybody was exploring the... Suddenly, whole areas of the world were being developed. New peoples were being discovered as sort of explorers went further and further afield. This was also the era when the universal language, Esperanto, was developed. In a sense of, you know, how do we communicate with all these different peoples in the world? We're meeting strangers and we don't know how to communicate with them. And so now Esperanto makes some sense in that it's a sort of common language that you can learn as a second language, and so can someone from China or Indonesia or the north of Canada. But what he invented, visible speech, was a Arabic speaker would say something and Bell's father, Melville Bell, would listen very carefully to it and reproduce in symbols. He had an elaborate system of symbols, exactly what that sound was. And then backstage, out of earshot, would be his son, Alec Bell. And he would then come on stage and look at the blackboard where his father had put up the symbols, what this man had, the words he had said, they would be in Arabic. The symbols for how he pronounced them would be on the blackboard. And Alec would look at them and can perfectly reproduce the Arabic sentence without knowing what he was saying.
I'm wondering about the development of the telephone from the time that he first came up with this prototype until something very common.
It was very fast. It took off very fast. As soon as he demonstrated it in Chicago in 1876, there was a sort of great exposition, and it was demonstrated there. And it was just one of those inventions that take off like that. Luckily, he had patented it, and so it went into production very fast. And it was just so extraordinary, because unlike the telegraph, which had been the only system available for long-distance communication for the previous 33 years, but for that you needed telegraph operators. You couldn't do it yourself. Whereas, of course, the telephone, once you've got the hang of how to dial and how to lift up the receiver, it's very democratic. You can speak directly to sort of somebody without specific training and a particular expertise. Interestingly, it took off incredibly fast in North America. It took longer to really take off in England, because in England, obviously, it was only going to be the wealthy people who were going to acquire these fancy new inventions. And in wealthy households with servants, nobody could decide who would answer the phone. Was that the role of the master of the house, or was that the role of his servant? And so there was about 5 years' resistance before that little sort of social class problem had to be. Then, in fact, the Bells went on this wonderful world tour, including going to Japan, and the telephone was taken up very rapidly by countries like China and Japan, where the written system was very complicated and where the telegraph had never operated very successfully.
I remember a quotation that I heard a little while ago where that somebody saw that demonstration and was so impressed by the utility of this new invention, he thought there'd be a market for one in every town.
Okay, yeah.
You were talking about Edison a little while ago, and I know in the past Edison and Tesla had a lot of problems with each other. Did they kind of try to bully out Bell?
Not Tesla, but Edison and Bell. There was a lot of, not so much Bell towards Edison, but Edison, who was a more sort of fiery, competitive character, was often slagged Bell, actually, and often sort of was very critical of him. And there was a lot of jealousy because Bell had been the first to invent the telephone and had made a lot of money.
Rebecca here had a question. She was wondering how you came to choose Mabel and Alec Bell as subjects.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
that was why I started with that picture that I saw when I went to Bedeck, the very first time I went to the Alexander Graham Bell Historic Site in Bedeck, which was when I was on a family holiday with my three sons, who were then quite little, and my parents from England. And we were driving around Cape Breton, and we went to the historic site and for Bell. We went into the museum, which is lovely because it's full of sort of crazy kites and inventions and things. And there was this huge photo of this elderly couple that I was talking about at the beginning. And that's when I thought, gosh, she looks interesting, Mabel Bell. I know all about him. He invented the telephone. I don't want to write about him, but she looks really interesting. And that's where I began, when I thought, oh, I'd like to know a little bit more about her, and then quickly realized that it had to be a sort of double biography because her life was half of an incredible partnership.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier his mother was deaf too, right?
Yeah.
Do you think that intrigued him in any way to want to marry and invent her because she was deaf, or that?
I think it meant that he was incredibly sympathetic to deaf people, and that he didn't share the widespread prejudice of the time, which was that if you were deaf, you were likely to be intellectually impaired. I mean, he knew that was absolute nonsense, and he always saw deaf people. He never saw them as deaf people. There were people he was very fond of who actually happened to have hearing problems, but that wasn't his concern. His mother was terribly proud of him and loved the fact that he was very, very musical, and she had a system of being able to enjoy it when he played the piano. She would hold a board. She would have one end of the board near the soundboard of the piano and the other end in her teeth so she could hear the vibrations.
He was quite a pianist, wasn't he?
He was a wonderful pianist, yeah. And he could do everything. He'd sort of Scottish ballads and hymns and Gilbert and Sullivan he loved. Great asset at any party. Yes.
And she can feel all the vibrations in that music.
There's a drummer who's deaf, an incredible drummer.
Yes.
And again, that's on vibrations.
Some DJ on your computer, to see it on the computer screen.
Yeah. That.
I've heard of a deaf DJ.
Was there any evidence of him having perfect pitch?
I think he did. I think he did, actually. Yes. Bell?
Yeah.
There was one published in about the 1960s.
He's not been fully recognised. They're happy with doing that in this country. But in England, they'll give him a knighthood. He was a Scotsman. Did he never get a knighthood?
No. But, you know, he's claimed by Americans and Scots and Canadians. But I think part of the reason that there weren't biographies of him was that he's owned by everybody and nobody does fall between the cracks.
Did the father and the son ever collaborate on anything?
To the father's regret, no. He'd like him to have collaborated on Visible Speech.
But Alexander was too much in his own head too.
That's right, yeah. And his father was a very dominating character.
Did you ever look into the contention that Bell never invented anything?
Yes.
He merely capitalized upon the efforts of others who couldn't manage the copyright expense.
There have been several accusations that Bell did not invent the telephone, that he stole the patent, that there were others elsewhere that invented it, just didn't have the wherewithal to patent it. But invention is more than just having the light bulb go on in your head. It is all the challenges of developing the prototype and getting the patent from the patent office. And I did look into those, some of them. Some of them were just crazy, actually. There was an Italian who was constantly claiming he'd invented the telephone without any sort of reasonable justification for his claims. Others were very close, but for whatever reason, they didn't quite cross the finish line in time.
How long did the litigations? You said there were 600 litigations?
Yeah. I think that patent protection lasted for, I can't remember, 40 years or something.
So in that period, there was that much litigation?
Yeah.
Quite a bit in your book about the struggles, and he hated all that business too, didn't he?
Oh, he wanted to walk away from it, which drove his father-in-law mad. In fact, it's interesting, after they'd got the patent for the telephone settled, his father-in-law, I think, was so frustrated with dealing with this exasperating character that he never tried to patent another of his inventions. I think he thought, you know, It's just, it's such a hassle, getting this man to fill in the paperwork.
So Charlotte's currently in Victoria to teach judges how to write in a way that can be understood by others.
That's right, yes. It's wonderful because actually we're very lucky in Canada. We have incredibly well-trained and smart judges. We have an incredible legal system, but sometimes they forget that most people don't walk around talking, using words like pursuant. So I go through their judges, their judgment, their decisions, very admiring of what they do, but saying things like, that sentence is 140 words long. Do you think you can cut it, cut it down a bit?
And could you talk about this project?
Oh, yes, I'll talk very briefly about Gold Diggers because I had the most exciting time 2 weeks ago. Gold Diggers is a book I published in 2010, which is about the gold rush in the 1890s. And it's a book where I decided I wasn't going to do a cradle-to-grave biography of an individual. I was going to do a biography of an event, and I wanted to do an event which lots of people had been part of and left memoirs and letters and diaries because, as you remember, I said for the kind of biographies I want to write, I need lots of primary material. So I chose the gold rush because nobody had written about it for quite a long time. I knew I was following in very large footsteps because Pierre Burton had written a brilliant book about the gold rush 50 years ago. But one of the things about Pierre Burton books is there are no women in them. You know, paragraph 2 always begins, come on, boys, follow me. And, you know, the cast of characters goes over the mountain or along the river or whatever it is. So I wanted to show that there were, to write about the gold rush and to have women there. And I wrote about it through the eyes of 6 characters, 4 men and 2 women, and who'd left great accounts of it. And the great thrill 2 weeks ago was that I went to Fortress Mountain outside Kananaskis in Alberta, where Scott Free Productions, which is Ridley Scott's production company, filming a $25 million TV miniseries. First of all, I watched this poor line of extras. I say poor because it was a cold day. They were wearing woolen clothes and leather boots, and they were climbing in a diagonal, one long line from the bottom of the mountain up the mountain. And of course, what they were was that iconic photograph from Canadian history of the Chilkoot Pass, which film company had recreated on Fortress Mountain. And I watched them climb up it. They were filmed, and then they had to go down to the bottom and start again. Which is actually very realistic, because in fact, when the miners went over the Chilkoot Pass to get to Dawson City, they all had to do it about 10 times, because they had to take 10,000 pounds of provisions with them. So that was pretty exciting, watching that. And then the next day, I went to a ranch outside Calgary where the production company has rebuilt Dawson City, which was incredible to see the set of that. So it's got a wonderful cast. They've got Sam Shepard and Tim Roth and Richard Madden and the character Belinda Mulrooney, who's one of the women characters I found, played by a very, according to the internet, she's hot. an Australian actress called Abby Cornish, and it's going to be on Discovery Television in early 2014. But for a writer, I have to tell you, it's such a buzz to sort of suddenly see the scenes you've written come to life. It's incredible. So that was my big excitement that I was telling Bruce about.
Somebody did the screenwrite for it?
Yes, I didn't do the screenplay.
That's a whole different kind of writing.
You're absolutely right. It's a completely different kind. And they've changed it quite a bit. They've fictionalized it, although I'm a non-fiction writer. But I'm fine with that.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being a wonderful...